From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. As the United States mourns more than 500,000 lives lost to the coronavirus, today the world has crossed an almost unimaginable threshold of 2.5 million deaths. The main vaccine on the front lines of global vaccination efforts is produced by Oxford AstraZeneca. But the vaccine has faced setbacks, supply shortages, and, of course, variant strains of the virus. Professor Sarah Gilbert is with the University of Oxford in England, and she led one of the two research teams that developed the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. Professor, yesterday, Ghana was the first country to receive your vaccine free of charge through the UN-backed COVAX plan, which ensures that poorer countries also have access to this life-saving vaccination. What is your plan, Professor, to make sure that this vaccine reaches the most vulnerable throughout the world?
Well, my work on ensuring the vaccine will reach the most vulnerable really started many years ago. This is a technology that I chose to use, having assessed a number of different vaccine technologies over the years. And one of the real benefits of this particular type of vaccine is the fact that it doesn't need frozen storage. It can be stored in a standard refrigerator and shipped using the same delivery systems as many, many other vaccines that are in use around the world today are used. And that's really important if we want to be able to use this vaccine widely. It has to feed into the existing distribution systems.
Well, that is a really important point because, as you say, your vaccine just needs to be refrigerated as opposed to Pfizer and Moderna, which need a really strict and expensive cold storage. And we continue to hear from epidemiologists that if only rich nations get vaccinated, we'll keep seeing these cycles of new variants and reinfections. So how do you go about designing a vaccine that can survive in poorer infrastructure networks?
It means that vaccines can be kept in a fridge and you can take out the number of doses that you need to use, and vaccines can stay in the fridge for up to 6 months, and you have more flexibility in how to use the vaccines. You're not having to thaw a whole box full and then try and use up the whole box before the very short expiry date after vaccines have been thawed.
Well, there have been setbacks at AstraZeneca, as you know. Yesterday, I spoke with our NPR correspondent in Berlin, where many there are asking for the Pfizer vaccine. They don't want the AstraZeneca vaccine. European regulators have given it about a 60% efficacy rate compared to as high as 95% for the Pfizer vaccine. We're seeing the same sorts of things in France and Italy and the UK. How do you respond, Professor, to those who say that the AstraZeneca vaccine is sort of second tier or a second class vaccine?
Well, we have to remember that in clinical trials, when only one vaccine is being assessed, what we're looking for is to see the safety of that vaccine and the efficacy of that vaccine in one particular situation. We can't then use the numbers to compare head to head with other vaccines. What we need for that is the real world effectiveness data that is now starting to come through. And we had some really exciting data come through from Scotland that was released on Monday. In general, the AstraZeneca vaccine was used in older people and the Pfizer vaccine in younger people. But actually, in that first analysis, we are seeing 94% effectiveness of the AstraZeneca vaccine, despite the fact that it's being used in older people. And the criticism from Europe was the lack of efficacy data in older adults. In about a month's time, we should have equivalent data from England coming through as well.
What about, Professor, the issues of efficacy of your vaccine against these new variants, specifically the South African variant of the coronavirus? The South African government, for example, was set to roll out the AstraZeneca vaccine but stopped distribution entirely earlier this month when data emerged that it provided little protection against this new strain. So how are you dealing with that?
I think it's unfortunate that the results have been somewhat misunderstood. What we have there is a relatively small trial. It's 2,000 individuals, so 1,000 had the vaccine and 1,000 had a placebo. And they're a young population. Median age was 31 years. So in that population, none of the people in the control group got a serious illness. And that means that we don't have any information that we can provide about the efficacy of the vaccine in preventing serious illness. That wasn't something that we could read out from our study.
I guess the bigger question, Professor, is it possible to edit your vaccine to adapt to these new variants? And what would that look like? Is that a booster shot, as Pfizer and Moderna are considering, or would you change the vaccine entirely?
It's something that's very easy to do. The reason we all use these platform technologies, as we call them, is that they're plug and play. You just put in the new sequence that you want to use and repeat the vaccine manufacturing. We actually started doing that in December, started looking at some different sequences to use in the vaccine, and we're considering a number of different options now. So we're preparing for a clinical trial of one of the new variants, the new spike sequence in the vaccine, to be trialled in a few months' time. We don't know that the variants that are now present in South Africa or in Brazil are going to be the variants that actually end up dominating. So we need to be prepared to respond to whatever is out there.
A lot of people in the United States, Professor, are wondering about U.S. approval of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Where do U.S. trials stand now?
Those phase three trials of 40,000 individuals are close to completion now. They were fully recruited in December, I believe. So the late stage follow-up has been going on, and there should be a readout from that trial quite soon.
That was Professor Sarah Gilbert with the University of Oxford. She led one of the two research teams that developed the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. Professor, thank you for your time and for your work.
Thank you.
The Biden administration is expected soon to release a declassified U.S. intelligence report that will address the role of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the 2018 murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The report is expected to say the Crown Prince approved the killing. Khashoggi was a Saudi citizen and Washington Post columnist who became a fierce critic of the regime. He was murdered on a visit to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, his body dismembered, never found. Aaron David Miller is a senior fellow with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former Middle East advisor to Republican and Democratic administrations. Welcome back.
Thanks so much, Vino.
The Crown Prince has always denied any direct involvement in Khashoggi's death, but it sounds like this declassified report from American intelligence officials will contradict him. How solid do you think that intelligence will be?
I think it's probably pretty good. I haven't seen the two-page document, which is probably heavily redacted, but it'll probably be enough to substantiate what I think the press has already reported, that with medium to high confidence, the intelligence community concluded that Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, ordered, certainly had foreknowledge and likely ordered the killing of Jamal Khashoggi.
Yeah, and the reason I ask that question is because the Saudis clearly have denied this, but how likely is it that a murder of that magnitude could happen without the Crown Prince knowing?
I mean, zero. There's zero chance. I mean, the fragmentary intelligence, the UN human rights rapporteur, some of the leaks from our own intelligence agencies and others, the Turks have weighed in heavily on this, indicate that there were a series of communications before and after the killing directly with the Crown Prince's office. And I should say, Peter, full disclosure, Jamal Khashoggi was a friend of mine. So I'm not entirely sure I'm objective on this matter, but it really does go beyond just MBS. The U.S.-Saudi relationship is out of control, and it's critically important that the Biden administration, per the president's own rhetoric on the campaign trail, put it back into balance.
Yeah, well, the report was created during the Trump administration, so we should be clear here. President Trump had this information. He didn't release it. The Biden administration is. How telling is that?
I think it's very telling. It suggests, along with a White House spokesperson Jen Psaki's notion that, right from the president, that Washington intends to recalibrate, quote-unquote, the relationship with the Saudis, I think it's very telling. Congress is all over this. There's zero support in this country for Saudi policies, certainly among the press and others. So there has to be some reckoning. The real question is, how is the president, Peter, going to reconcile his fiery rhetoric on the campaign with the realities? Perhaps unlike Lehman Brothers, the U.S.-Saudi relationship is too big to fail. But right. I truly hope that the president does take some actions that will bring it back into balance.
Well, let's dig into that just a little bit more deeply, because there will be implications if the relationship deteriorates. These two countries have traditionally relied on each other economically and also from a security standpoint in the Middle East.
Yeah, although the bloom is really off the rose. The central trade-off, we need their oil and they need our security, has essentially broken down. I mean, we're virtually independent of Arab hydrocarbons while the rest of the world is not. It's critically important that we maintain a relationship with Saudi Arabia until the world frees itself to a large degree from Arab hydrocarbons, and that's going to take quite some time. But over the last year and a half, two years, we've seen U.S.-Saudi relations diverge, both on Yemen and human rights. The Saudis are now negotiating with the Chinese for build some nuclear reactors. They seem to be not interested in the 123 agreement that would create the kinds of standards that are that we would require. So the interests have departed. I would argue Saudi Arabia is not an ally. It's more a partner. We don't share common values, and our interests do align, although not in every issue. I just think that the president needs to make it unmistakably clear. There's got to be a deep freeze with respect to contacts with Mohammed bin Salman. And I think the president should send an emissary to Riyadh for a frank discussion.
Yeah.
That the U.S.-Saudi relationship is at great risk. We want to continue it, but the king and others need to control MBS.
All right. Aaron David Miller, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Take care.
That's British jazz saxophonist Binker Golding. He's one of the musicians urging his government to renegotiate a better Brexit deal for a Europe-wide visa-free work permit for touring musicians and artists. Because now, after the UK's messy split with Europe, British musicians have to get a visa for every country they play in and get permits and pay fees for their sound equipment and instruments. These rules come on top of a miserable year for professional musicians who haven't been able to tour or perform live because of the pandemic. I spoke to Binker Golding about how these new Brexit rules will affect him, and he told me that the next time he wants to play at a festival in France, for instance, it'll be far more complicated.
What they're going to say is, well, we've got a Binker Golding in London and we've got another guy in Stockholm that's basically the same. Which one are we going to go for? The guy in London that's got all of the red tape around him because of Brexit? Or are we going to go with the guy in Sweden or something where things are nice and easy and we don't even have to deal with all of this stuff? And they're not just going to do that with me. They're going to do that with every single musician in the sort of middle class area of working musicians. They're not going to do it with Ed Sheeran, but they're going to do it with a lot of people underneath Ed Sheeran.
And it's making people very angry. The great Elton John has been outspoken about this. He's pointed out that, you know, it doesn't matter for him. He's a superstar. He can afford these extra costs and restrictions and that sort of thing. But what about for people like you, when you need to get visas and passports and pay for your equipment and the gear coming through? What does that mean for you?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. So Elton John, you know, he should be having his feet up by the fire, having a cup of tea, ready for semi-retirement or something. And instead, he's got to go online and make noise about the bloody, you know, the situation. And it doesn't, as you say, it doesn't even affect him. He's a multi-millionaire 10 times over, maybe 100 times over.
But he knows it affects you.
But yes, but he's seen the injustice and he's calling it out and he's saying this is ridiculous.
How does playing Europe, how important has that been for your career?
In the last 5 years, it's been hugely important. It's made up, you know, a very big portion of my personal income. I would say about 50%, right? It's probably more like 65%. And that's not just true for me. That's true for a number of other people that I know. And that's not just true for the musicians. That's true for the touring teams, the people that rig stages and do sound and all of these kind of people that you don't see because they're not performing on stage, but they're just as crucial. And so,
well, and from what I understand, it's actually not just musicians either. It also affects actors, visual artists, other performers.
Sure.
Patrick Stewart
sure.
even wrote a letter asking Boris Johnson to negotiate new terms with the EU that would allow people, artists like you, to work more freely in Europe. But let me ask you, why should artists be treated any differently? There's probably 1,000 other industries across the United Kingdom that could make the same argument that Brexit has hurt their business.
Exactly. This is the thing. This government that we've got in the UK at the moment, they claim to be a conservative government. The conservatives traditionally are supposed to respect and encourage entrepreneurship, people that set up small businesses and small industry and things like this. They're supposed to encourage those people. And what happened was the EU have offered this visa. And instead of acting like traditional conservatives and saying, well, let this particular portion of the population, i.e. musicians, let them benefit from this offer. Why not? you know, this is a good thing for business. They can keep on employing people. They can go forth and conquer, so to speak. They can earn money and bring that money back into the country, and that money will be taxed. Instead of saying that, they acted like Stalinists and said, no, no one is allowed to be different. If we're in Brexit, we're all in Brexit together in an extreme fashion, and that's it.
Isn't there some wisdom to that, though? I mean, because if they start making and carving out exceptions for you, then they have to do the same thing for the oyster farmer, right? I mean, everybody.
Yeah, sure. I hear what you're saying fully. But my argument is they should be cutting deals for the oyster people. They should be trying to cut deals for these people. That's what they're there for. I'm not saying that musicians should be an exception on their own. I'm saying every single thing down the line, if you put Brexit on the table, you've got to have a plan, or you've got to be prepared to fight to the dying death for every single group of people that come forward to you with an issue. And if you can't do that, then you should have never put the referendum on the table in the first place.
Yeah, well, yeah. And as you well know, I mean, we've been covering Brexit for years. But you've been living it for years. You know that the negotiations were fraught and they were nearly impossible. I mean, many times it didn't seem like there was going to be any deal struck whatsoever because it was so complicated to figure out. So do you hold out any hope now that Boris Johnson is going to be interested or willing to consider this particular issue and try to get changes to what you're asking for?
I think this particular issue will probably be very low on the list. In this country, at least in my lifetime, which is the last 35 years, I would not say that they are particularly geared towards seeing the arts as a beneficial and profitable area, which it is both. The arts are massively beneficial to humanity, and they can't understand that. And on the other hand, it's very good for industry. The arts is extremely good for, you know, financially speaking. But they just don't really seem to recognize that.
Yeah, interesting to hear you make that point from a country that has produced some of the most influential musicians and rockers of all time. But before I let you go, let's listen to some of your music. Sure. Here's Strange, Beautiful, Remembered from 2019. So there's Brexit, but it's also been much tougher for you to play that for a live audience because of the pandemic, of course. How has the past year been for you? Because you have been just unable to travel regardless of Brexit.
Sure, exactly. So all of this couldn't have rolled together at a worse time. The pandemic has been extremely quiet here on the work front. So last year, I probably did about 5 shows, and in a normal year I'd do more than that in 2 weeks, you know. Luckily financially my back isn't too much against the wall, so I can survive. But I do feel for people that are just starting out in this industry. I really do, because it's a very, very tough time, the toughest I've known. There's a lot of people that have suffered, man. Yeah, I mean, it's not just musicians.
No doubt about that. Saxophonist Binker Golding, a musician facing new regulations that will make it more difficult to tour in Europe after Brexit. Binker, good luck to you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
To Colorado now, where they're giving away free electric bicycles. The program is just one part of the state's plan to confront climate change. Those ambitions rely on getting people out of their cars, and as Colorado Public Radio's Sam Brash reports, the e-bikes are an early attempt to do that and to help lower-income Coloradans.
The cold hasn't stopped Shalon Bowens from taking a spin on her e-bike.
It's a beautiful ruby red bike, and it has my little bougie shopping bag back here, so you can go shopping with the bag on the back.
Bowens got her e-bike for free through a program with the Colorado Energy Office. Last fall, it gave out 13 e-bikes to essential workers. They cost about $1,800 each. Bowens qualified since she works for a sexual health clinic in East Denver.
I cried. I did. I was so happy because I was like, oh my God, I got the bike.
Wheeltour directs the Energy Office. The agency is leading Colorado's efforts to confront climate change, and he says that'll mean big changes to transportation, which produces more emissions than any other piece of the state's economy.
I think that equity in transportation is really important, and that as we move to clean transportation, we need to keep that in mind.
Past efforts to support more sustainable types of transportation haven't always helped lower-income people. Take tax credits for electric vehicles. In Colorado, those often go toward Teslas or other luxury cars. But Tour says the e-bike program is a test run for a different kind of program.
We certainly wouldn't argue that alone it's going to address the transportation challenges that the state has.
The pilot program has shown promising results. E-bike recipients logged their activity in an app and gave interviews to program administrators. The results show they replaced car trips with bike trips about 3 times per week. E-bike rider Shalon Bowen says it's been a tremendous help for her mental and physical health. She likes that the bike can do 20 miles per hour all on its own, but still lets her pedal along when she wants a workout.
I lost 70 pounds. I lost a lot of weight. I lost 70 pounds riding his bike all the time.
The Colorado Energy Office is now on to the next round. It's taking applications for another 100 plus e-bikes or so, this time for organizations rather than individuals. It's a tiny piece of Colorado's bigger plans for transportation and climate change. But Bowen says it's always good to get moving.
There you go. Yes.
For Here and Now, I'm Sam Brash in Denver.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
He was one of the most consequential architects of the civil rights movement, but you may never have heard of him.
For our Black History Month special series, Bayard Rustin, who made nonviolence part of the fight for civil rights and organized the March on Washington.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
Tango Delta.
Touchdown confirmed. Perseverance safely on the surface of Mars, ready to begin seeking the sands of past life.
1 week ago, NASA's Perseverance rover landed on Mars, and now it's sending back vivid panoramic photos detailing the surface of a Martian crater. As we get these high-definition looks at another world, scientists like Brian E. Horgan are about to get a lot more data to work with. Horgan is part of NASA's Mars Perseverance team, and she joins us now on Skype. Welcome.
Hello, nice to be here.
Nice to have you. And that 360-degree panorama, it is so amazingly beautiful. When you look at it with your scientific eyes, what do you see?
Oh, I see so much incredible geology that I can't wait to get out there and take a closer look at. You know, we landed in such an amazing spot and such an incredible landing site that this is really just confirming everything we were hoping for.
And what do you mean by that? It's confirming what you thought.
Oh, it's confirming that we thought this were, there was so much incredible geologic diversity at this site. You know, we've landed and we've already seen, you know, so many different kinds of rocks just sitting on the surface around us. And one of the big things we're excited about is the place we landed specifically is a great place to try to look for ancient lava on Mars. You know, we'd really love to get a sample of lava because it's, or any kind of volcanic deposit like that, because we can actually use that to date, to get a real date for when everything happened in Jezero Crater, if we can get a sample and bring that back to Earth.
And what about the sounds that the Perseverance is sending back from the surface? You can hear the mechanical buzz of the rover and the wind blowing. Let's hear that again. It is almost overwhelming to think that that sound that is so familiar came from another world.
Yeah, I mean, I think those sounds are every planetary scientist's dream to hear in person, right? And this is the next best thing, is to hear it from our robot friend on the ground. Hmm. You know, our rovers get us pretty close. They send us beautiful images that allow you to imagine standing there. But I think adding that, the soundtrack and adding the winds, really makes it so much easier to imagine just being there and actually soaking in this completely alien planet.
Yeah. So what's next? I know you're also preparing to attempt to fly that helicopter off the rover.
So the helicopter is our first time, if anyone's first time flying on another planet, and that's a big deal. You know, showing that we can actually have powered flight on another planet will really open up whole new avenues for missions to Mars and other planets. It'll also be a great kind of test run for the Dragonfly mission, which is a quadcopter that NASA is sending to Saturn's moon Titan sometime in the next 10 years. So that's, you know, I think it opens up a new era in planetary exploration. That's really exciting.
And one of the main missions, of course, is to find evidence of new life or past life on Mars. How are you going to go about testing for that? And when does that phase begin?
Yeah, so we'll be starting our real mission, kind of the core, the heart of what we're trying to do, which is searching for signs of ancient microbial life, after we finish checking out the rover and finish off the helicopter phase. So to do that, what we'll be doing is visiting a couple of really key sites in the crater, particularly the delta that's in Jezero Crater. We think is a great place to look for concentrated organic materials washed down from rivers into the lake and concentrated in the bottom of the lake. There are also some amazing, we think are beach deposits right around the rim of this ancient crater. Formed in the ancient lake, there would be great places to look for signs of ancient microbial beach bums that might have once been living in microbial colonies along the shore of the lake. So, yeah, and you know, this rover is set up to do an incredible job looking for those kinds of things.
We cannot wait to see more and to learn more. Brian E. Horgan, scientist with NASA's Mars Perseverance mission, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gerald McWhorter grew up hearing the stories about his great-great-grandfather Frank, who he later realized was an underappreciated figure in American history. Frank was born into slavery, later came to buy his freedom, and then in 1836 became the first black person to legally plan and set up a community in America. He founded the abolitionist town of New Philadelphia in western Illinois. The town no longer exists, but the National Park Service is considering this site to be part of the National Park System. Gerald McWhorter and his wife, Kate Williams McWhorter, researched the story of New Philadelphia, and Gerald joins us now to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
And what a story this is. Tell us a little bit about your great-great-grandfather.
Well, it's an interesting story. He was a slave in Kentucky who was able to hire out, and in doing so was able to save some money of his own. And the first person that he purchased out of slavery was his wife, who lived in the next plantation because she was pregnant, and he wanted their next child to be born free. Mm. And that really is the story of his life, really, is the pursuit of freedom for himself, his family, and for a community that was an abolitionist village, as you said, in the 1830s.
So he founded this town, New Philadelphia, in 1836. Why did he want to create this special place, his own town, and why there?
Well, it's interesting. When he was in Kentucky, his first son became a freedom seeker and left and the Underground Railroad and went to Canada. He married a woman born in England. Frank had to pay two or three times the price in order to secure his freedom so that he could return to Kentucky. But when he returned to this woman from England, it was time to leave Kentucky. And so they were able to exchange the money that he had and the business ventures that he actually had in Kentucky for land sight unseen, which was part of the Illinois military tract that was part of the land that was given by the federal government to veterans of the War of 1812. And so he was able to get someone to see the land. He was able to buy it, and then off they went. Mm. He was then able to start selling the lots in order to acquire money to go back to buy additional family members. Mm. He ended up purchasing 16 family members directly, and then he left money after he died in the 1850s in order that other relatives could continue to purchase family members. Mm. And as we say, here was a town owned by black people who lived 20 miles from slavery. This is 20 miles from the Mississippi River and Missouri, which was a slave state, and they had guns. And so it's an amazing story.
Yeah, 25 miles from a slave market of Hannibal, Missouri.
Yes.
I mean,
yep.
Tell me why this place was called New Philadelphia.
We have documents that link the McWhorter family back to the abolitionist movement. And Philadelphia was one of those centers that impacted the country in terms of abolitionism. And so that's really the connection we make that it was the new city of brotherly love.
And New Philadelphia was a refuge for freedom seekers, right? Many would swim across the Mississippi River to get to New Philadelphia. And as you say, it would become a station on the Underground Railroad.
Yes. And there were families that, one family in particular, the Walker family, was also a family that purchased family members out of slavery. And they then settled in New Philadelphia. And as it turned out, the McWhorter men married Walker women. And so there was that kind of union that was going on.
Yeah. So tell us what life was like in New Philadelphia. What did Free Frank create?
Well, it's interesting because this was a relatively small town, as there were many such towns that were created during this historical period. But it ended up having a post office. It had a blacksmith shop. It had a large house that served as a hotel. It had a church, which also served as a school. And what's interesting is that we grew up with the oral history that freedom seekers could get to New Philadelphia and get a pair of shoes and a horse. And those McWhorter boys would help you get to Canada. Mm. So that's a story we grew up with. And as it turns out, there was archaeological digs sponsored by the National Science Foundation that actually discovered there were two cobblers in the town. Mm. And there weren't that many feet in the town to require two shoemakers. So it tended to corroborate the story that we grew up with.
Well, and what's so interesting is that this was an integrated town, that black farmers yes. worked next to white farmers, and black children were schooled with white children, and black families and white families attended church together. I mean, you can't overstate what an extraordinary place this was.
Well, what's interesting is that even in Pike County, which is the county where it's located, the southern part of the county was known as White Pike. There were other little towns where there were articles in the press at the time that indicated there was racial violence. We have not found any evidence that there was any violence in New Philadelphia. And even during the Civil War, the sons of New Philadelphia went to fight in the Civil War, although they could not join the same units. So white youth joined right out of Pike County, whereas the African Americans, McWhorters and Vaughns and others, had to go to other places to join the Union Army, but they did. And we often say that every way you could get to freedom, the struggle took place in New Philadelphia, whether it was the Underground Railroad, whether it was fighting in the Civil War. And it has to be an example to really make history from the bottom up something that can inspire and bring meaning, really, to people's lives. And about New Philadelphia, what we say is that if New Philadelphia was possible, then maybe America's possible.
Mm. New Philadelphia, Illinois, is no longer a town. What happened to it?
Well, two things. One is the railroad didn't come through New Philadelphia. And Professor Fennell, an anthropologist at the University of Illinois, did research on this and found that if the railroad had gone in a straight line, it would have passed through New Philadelphia. But instead, it almost bumped to the north and went around New Philadelphia. And there's debate around that. There were people in Hannibal that were a part of that process, so that there's this whole question of whether or not it was intentionally diverted away from New Philadelphia. Mm. Mm. But the other aspect of it is that it really was about jobs. So people migrated to where there was work. And that meant that industry, whether it was Chicago or St. Louis, or other places attracted. So in our family, Chicago was the destination for my father, who became a steel worker, my uncle, who became a bus driver, my aunt, who became a elementary school teacher in Chicago.
Hmm. New Philadelphia is now a National Historic Landmark. Why does this story matter so much today?
There are at least two major lessons that make New Philadelphia important historically. One is this question of community. It seems to me that as a community of people welcoming each other is an example of something that we'd really need to learn about today. And the second is this question of freedom, because if New Philadelphia was able to gather people together, blacks and whites, in fighting and struggling for freedom in every conceivable way you could, then it seems to me that would be an inspirational reference point for people to resist this white supremacy that unfortunately plagues the land today.
That's Gerald McWhorter, Professor Emeritus of Information Sciences and African American Studies at the University of Illinois. Gerald, thank you so much for bringing this story to us.
Thank you so much for having me and valuing it as well.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's troubles are growing. A former aide who first accused the governor of sexual harassment in December now says he tried to kiss her in 2018 and invited her to play strip poker on a government plane. Governor Cuomo denies these claims, but they only compound the controversies he's dealing with. Cuomo was accused of suppressing information about the number of COVID deaths in New York nursing homes. And his younger brother, Chris, an anchor for CNN, is under scrutiny by media watchdogs for helping the governor smooth over his image with cozy on-air interviews. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is watching that part of the story, and he joins me now. David, hi.
Hey, Peter.
And I'm sure you remember when the pandemic started, Governor Cuomo was praised for his seemingly open and honest press conferences. How would you describe the evolution of that image in the past few months?
Well, he's come crashing back down to earth as a politician dealing with a tough reality during the pandemic, and one who's in some ways submerged reality of being kind of a bruising political figure is ever more being dragged into light. I mean, he's being looked at like a politician now instead of some sort of crusading hero.
Well, as his problems grow, as we said, his brother Chris Cuomo accused of helping smooth out the governor's reputation by using his platform on CNN. I want to listen to this clip now from March 2020.
Governor Andrew Cuomo, I appreciate you coming on the show. I love you. I'm proud of what you're doing. I know you're working hard for your state, but no matter how hard you're working, there's always time to call mom. She wants to hear from you. Just so you know.
Yeah, I called mom. Just before I came on this show.
It's not what
By the way, she said I was her favorite.
She never said
Good
that.
News is she said you were her second favorite.
Okay, and that was as the pandemic was breaking out. So how did CNN justify this type of interview?
Well, they said, look, people are responding to it. In the press conferences, Cuomo had embodied a humane sensibility, a sense of empathy, and a sense of a kind of agency in a way that federal officials in some ways were not, particularly from then President Trump. And people responded to that warmly. You know, there was this Mutt and Jeff routine that Chris Cuomo and his brother, the governor, were doing on CNN. People reacted and embraced it. You know, some people were turned off, but nonetheless, it was seen as lifting us out of the dispiriting reality to see this back and forth between even these two very famous, influential people kind of teasing each other online and yet doing it at a distance and at a remove because that's the reality we were all in. That's how CNN justified it. They said, look, you're not turning to that for news updates. You're turning that for a kind of news-infused comedic banter.
Well, the situation has changed. In a Washington Post editorial last week, CNN said that they made an exception to the rule at first when they allowed Cuomo to interview his brother, because that's a very odd scenario. It doesn't happen hardly at all or ever. But now, because of this scrutiny, he is no longer allowed to speak with the governor on air. How do you think, in retrospect, CNN should have handled this?
Well, it's tough. I mean, on principle, my feeling is you can do almost anything as a journalist and as a news outlet that you're willing to disclose fully to your audiences and your viewers and readers and listeners. And certainly CNN made no secret of the family tie between them. And it said, look, we can have people cover other people cover him the other 22, 23 hours of the day. But it did mean that the dominant impression people got of Andrew Cuomo from CNN was one of kind of an affable older brother, a bit of a scourge, but kind of a teasing, responsible, forceful actor, you know, and used that kind of mystique to launch a book that was released in fall saying, look how wonderfully I've handled this. These are the lessons of leadership, when some of those lessons don't seem as clear now in retrospect. There are some questions about his transparency, his accountability, his honesty in dealing with this terrible plague. CNN maybe could have done that as a comedic turn and diminished how much time they devoted to it. You know, the ability to do it live and ad nauseum doesn't mean you have to do it. But I think in retrospect, you know, it wasn't that they were cleaning up something they knew would be a problem. It just, you know, reminds you Andrew Cuomo, no matter how much he loves his brother, remains a public figure that a news institution like CNN has to keep holding accountable.
And considering what we now know, do you think those interviews did any damage? In other words, were they responsible for making the governor look better than he should have?
They certainly allowed him to present himself in a most humane and human and empathetic and amusing light possible. And this was at a time where New York was at the forefront of some of the most deadly and most problematic elements. New York did seem to address those. I'm sure the governor was facing very tough choices, and it's not clear yet to me that what he did made things more deadly in essentially forcing nursing homes to take COVID patients back from hospitals. But we don't know that because in part we're just going through the data now that only belatedly has become released to the public. That's not how public officials are supposed to work. And to be honest, it's not how news organizations typically should work.
Yeah. In less than 30 seconds here, David, what kind of damage does this do to CNN's reputation, if any?
I think CNN will ride it out. You know, it has had controversies before under its current chief, Jeff Zucker, or under whoever takes office or ownership, you know, and leadership of it. You know, they're just trying to get the best ratings they can to hold on to their attention and then acquit themselves admirably in key moments. This is a moment where people embrace them. In retrospect, yeah, it doesn't look as good.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Jane Clayson in Boston. This is Here and Now.